I'm Lee Hay. In 1969, there were two streets in Cincinnati which were a hotbed for young activists, music lovers, and hippies: Calhoun Street and Ludlow Avenue, both near the University of Cincinnati. Young people traveled hours to be part of this peace and love scene, and the Ludlow Garage, which opened at 346 Ludlow Avenue on September 19, 1969, was one of the destinations. Nicknamed the Fillmore of the Midwest, it was a dream for music fans and bands alike. Tonight, you'll hear a roundtable discussion with the owner, Jim Tarbell, three of the folks who worked with him, Margie Hayes, Jeff Seerfeld, and Bill Cunningham, plus Michael Hodash, who had a shop on Calhoun. You'll also hear from Bob Knave, who played there with the Lemon Pipers, and Dale Rabner, who attended many concerts. This is a tribute to the 40th anniversary of the Ludlow Garage.
Hi, this is Dale Rabner from DHR Music, and as is the case all too often, I think it was Joni Mitchell that said, "You don't appreciate what you got till it's gone." Unbeknownst to lots of Cincinnatians, we were really at the forefront. I remember when Jelly Pudding 102.7 broadcast just one time a night, and then I remember the Ludlow Garage, and as a person that had lived in Chicago and had been at Wells Street, Old Town, and been at Kinetic Playground, and had also been out to the West Coast to see various groups in San Francisco at Fillmore West and Winterland, and then on to New York and Fillmore East. We had some amazing groups coming through there at a time before they were not particularly well known. Some that come to mind right away would be Santana, the Allman Brothers, which were at that point primarily just a touring group, not to mention the Lemon Pipers. I personally think it's a travesty that they got caught doing what was back in the day called bubblegum music, but their blues is just phenomenal. Before they became the Eagles or even Joe Walsh, it was known as the James Gang from up in Cleveland, and they were quite phenomenal. And I guess one of my favorite stories was about the Maharaji. Someone had asked him how he was doing, and he said, "You think everything is hippie groovy? Everything is not hippie groovy." Oh, I guess I'd be remiss if I didn't mention the Sons of Champlin, who are probably one of my all-time favorite groups. Bill Champlin, having then gone on to Chicago and writing two very big hits for George Benson and Earth, Wind, and Fire, and anytime I can see them, I would most definitely enjoy doing that. As you get older, they say those early memories get better and better, but I can honestly say those were some of the very best memories of my life, and we have a wonderful heritage here in Cincinnati.
I'm Bob Knave, and back in the mid-60s to the 1969, I was a member of a band from Cincinnati, actually from Oxford, Ohio, called the Lemon Pipers, that had a modicum of success. And then after the Lemon Pipers, put a group together called Beechwood Farm. That group almost made it, but not quite. Nonetheless, both groups played at the Ludlow Garage. I remember the garage being, for us, it was like the Fillmore of Cincinnati, and it was the second of such type venues. The first, as I remember, being the Black Dome, which was housed in what used to be an Albert supermarket in Clifton. We had an opportunity to see Dr. John and Procol Harum. Silver Apples was an interesting group. John Mayall came through. In fact, I ended up purchasing a Hammond organ from John as a result of that trip. But Jim Tarbell had this this vision, I guess, that he wanted to get it on in Cincinnati. And it was about the same time that the popularity of the Jelly Pudding radio program was growing immensely.
Well, today, right now, I guess, is a day of national mourning for Dr. Martin Luther King. So we plan to honor him somehow on the blues show tomorrow afternoon, beginning at 4 o'clock. No Jelly Pudding tomorrow night. Be back again 10 o'clock Monday night, and Monday through Friday, 10 to 12, as usual, okay? Michael Xanadu, thanking you for tuning in. Peace. There never has been a better time for love, people, but if that doesn't work, protect your head.
So somehow he managed to finagle the space on Ludlow Avenue that at one time was, I think, a garage for either milk trucks or bakery trucks or something like that. Big space. What I remember about the room itself, there were no chairs. There were some rugs on the floor. There was a bar. No alcohol was served, but they sold fruit. You could buy an orange or a banana and soft drinks and water. And there were two huge rocking chairs that stood, I don't know, 8 feet tall, that three or four people could sit in one of them. That was kind of an oddity or something special about the garage. Dan Britt and Rick Lemker were two guys that kind of built the PA system, the sound system. They did some pretty decent recordings there, considering the technology of the day. It was all reel-to-reel. I just remember it was a fun place to be, a fun place to play, and I have a lot of fond memories of that. Probably the most special moments for me were for the Lemon Pipers opening for the Allman Brothers in 1969 and also opening for the Sons of Champlin. That was a very special evening.
Free electric classifieds.
We're going to have to delay this for a minute here. We'll put on a tune. We just hit a little accident in the control room.
The federal grand jury investigating Vice President Agnew resumed its session in Baltimore today.
The Allman Brothers will be appearing in Cincinnati this weekend, along with the Frost and the Glass Wall at the Ludlow Garage, this Friday and Saturday night. Two shows each night, beginning at 8 p.m. Admission for the whole evening is just $3.
There was a period there where Jim Tarbell, who promoted the place, brought in some really good national groups that had not quite risen to stardom yet. I remember seeing Spirit at the garage. Lots of Dr. John, Tracy Nelson, and Boss Gags together in RBQ right after they got busted, and they all came out with their heads shaved, and that was, I think Terry Adams was wearing a sailor hat. And Ludlow Garage to me was it was the mecca for progressive rock music back in the late 60s.
My name is Michael Hodesh. I started a business in the summer of 1967, which of course was the summer of love. After a trip halfway around the world, I got inspired and decided that it was time for me to do something. At that point in time, the action was on Calhoun Street. Down the street was the Black Dome, which was originally the Italian Seaman's Hall. Later, there was another music venue across the street called the Renaissance. Next to me, there was Mark Bellina's Sandal Shop. Next to that, and down the street, there was the Shaker Plane. Oh, and also, of course, there was Love's Coffee House. And there was a Golden Triangle.
The Falafel House, Family Owl.
And of course, originally, there was the Mug Club.
Yeah.
And the Seven Cities with Lee Dorfman. And the Nebbish. There was Rick Schroes' head shop.
Yeah.
It was quite an area. And I opened up a store that was a combination of head shop, poster store, and clothing store, selling the latest fashions, which were usually striped pants. And one leg was striped and the other leg was paisley. And it was decorated by Larry Goshorn in the back room, who was a member of the Sacred Mushroom at the time and later became a member of the Pure Prairie League. It was an interesting scene on Calhoun Street. It was before Jim made his move on Ludlow Avenue. And Jim's move was very timely because Calhoun Street was being closed down very quickly. The city of Cincinnati was not happy with it. The city came in and they really cracked down on the street. Too many hippies, too many weird dressers, and basically met its end. The people from the Shaker Plain ended up moving to Ludlow because it seemed like to be a more viable area. I closed my place and ended up moving downtown. And George's Delicatessen, he went out of business. And that was the end of Calhoun Street. But I'm glad to be here with Jim. I think Jim has always been an innovator here when he brought the Grateful Dead in, which was probably the start of everything.
Well, I'm Jim Tarbell, and I'm 66 this year, and when I was about 26, I had been the director of the Hyde Park Teen Center in the late 60s, and the Teen Center ran its course, but I was kind of stricken with the music bug and its relevance to youth culture, and felt that Cincinnati could use something like a music center and a nightclub. And it was really envisioned as being more of a community center with the emphasis on music. Music quickly took over as the preoccupation of our program there. And I found an old building on Ludlow Avenue in Clifton, which had been historically called the Ludlow Garage. It was an automobile dealership and had then become a repair garage, and then it became kind of a storage depot for garbage trucks. And at the time, it was in serious disrepair, but it seemed like an appropriate venue size and location. So I was able to find financial backing for it, and off we went in the early summer of 69 in terms of getting it ready. And then this wonderful group of folks kind of fell together, some of whom I knew. Mr. Cunningham is here, that I knew prior to that, and recruited them to be part of the staff. Others came from hither and yon to be part of it as supporters, volunteers, and or regular employees. It was short, but very sweet. It was a great place, a great time. It was a great insight into American culture, I think, Cincinnati culture.
I'm Jeff Sierveld. I was one of the original teen crew, a precocious youth that started working with Jim. I was familiar with Jim when he started the Hyde Park Teen Center, as my cousin lived over in his neighborhood and got around there. And as kids, we thought we were going to get involved in something really cutting edge and rock and roll, and how counterculture that was, part of the movement of the times. And little did we know, we were being hoodwinked into being a regular crew, cleaning up this and fixing that. But it was a great experience. We were certainly exposed to quite a few things, adult and entertaining, which Cincinnati wasn't great on, adult entertainment. And they used to have Charlie Keating and the rest go run around and try and stop that kind of stuff. So the garage was not unfamiliar with those kinds of things, running into problems with noise. And, well, it was music, but for the outside, it was noise. And so we had all those issues. But we did manage to have a really great time, and looking back over the list of performers that came through our doors, it was an incredible time, only to be rivaled by New York and L.A. There really wasn't much else in Cincinnati, especially for kids to get involved in, that really, I guess, would require an adult nowadays in the business. It has changed quite a bit, but we did manage to capture some of that spirit and bring it along. Several of the people that were involved in the garage have remained either in art or music. So it's great to have been involved as a youth and to have
when
continued that tradition
you
now.
Went away, I cried for so long. I wanted you. Thank you.
Margie Hayes. I actually was the accountant at the Ludlow Garage, and probably one of the few people that didn't get to see too many of the concerts. I could hear them because my office was under the stage, but I learned to tune that out early. I spent a good bit of time answering phones, arguing with road managers, counting tickets, going back and forth to the banks, chasing Mr. Tarbell down for scraps of paper that got put somewhere. I know I had it. It was a great time. It was the best fun. The musicians were great, with few exceptions. Even the road managers weren't too bad. It's the kind of thing that you wish was still around, because there are no other places like that where people can go for not a whole lot of money, listen to some good music, and have some fun.
Yeah, my name is Bill Cunningham. My story is a lot simpler. When I found out what Jim was doing at the garage, I wanted free music. So I ended up working at the concession stand down there. And that was just the beginning with Jim. I worked his concession stand at Arnold's for a long time, and also at Grammar's and helping run Grammar's, where Margie showed up eventually for a while. That pretty much brings me up to where I am now.
You're managing the Comet, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm managing the Comet.
Just wanna love you.
As soon as it was announced, it provoked arguably the largest turnout of public officials from City Hall since World War II, all of whom, of course, had serious concerns. And it all had to do with hair and beards, basically. And the funny part was that I had chosen Ludlow because I thought it was a more stable environment and a better place to have this venue. But it wasn't understood by a lot of people in Clifton and on Ludlow, the business owners. It wasn't understood by the public officials. So I managed to get a visit from every department head, I think, known to man. Well, leading up to some code requirements that were very unusual. That is to say, very stringent.
The floor was coated with, better than an inch of grease and whatever else came out of those things. To us, it was a huge place.
Yeah, it was.
It was 10,000 square feet.
10,000, two floors.
On each of two floors.
Right, and covered with that much grease on the floor, we brought in a compound called Zep, which was the color of tang but turned iridescent green in the water as it dissolved the grease. Ordinances that we got in trouble for when we were sandblasting the walls inside to bring them back to natural brick. They made us put up plastic because of the dust, and then we made us hose dust down so that it wouldn't come out our doors into the street. They really, the noise of the compressor that we used, they were not happy about as we prepped the place. So from the very beginning, they really were not thrilled to have us moving in necessarily, although as the idea of a community place, it really did bring quite a few kids that could have otherwise been in a lot of trouble into a place to work very hard towards a single goal of a great entertainment venue. So we built the stage sections out of 4x8 foot sheets of plywood. Those were actually carried over to the Zoo Mini Pop Festival and set up, waiting for the sound system to come in. We put up a huge light screen for our favorite light show guys, Flavorscope, who had also performed at Jim's Hyde Park Teen Center and other clubs around the city. And they put on a great show during that. The screen tour, and one of my memories was having to climb to the top of the scaffold to repair the light show screen while Grand Funk Railroad played. Never cared for them much since, but there you go.
Just shortly before it was time to open, which ran September 1st, 1969, I came to work one morning. There was this big red sticker on my front door that said, "Stop, stop everything, don't do any more work." Yeah, it's called a stop work order. And ended up having to hastily arrange the first concert, which was with the Youngbloods. The first concert ended up being at the Emory Theater, and it was arranged in a matter of a week, I guess. It turned out to be a great, absolutely great, great event. Emory had kind of been forgotten. Most people who grew up at that time that were concert goers hadn't been to the Emory, so it was kind of a new discovery for them. And it was a great theater that was, I mean, acoustically as good as it gets. Crowd was on its feet very shortly after the music started playing, stayed on their feet all night. Jesse Colin Young and the Youngbloods, and Come On People Now was real hot at the time. And Lonnie Mack, who was an institution already in the music world, was from across the border in Indiana as the second act, and then Balderdash, a local favorite, as the third act. That was kind of the format of the program at the Garage. Basically, it was three bands, not always, but frequently, one local, one regional, and one national. And that would make up for an evening. Each group would usually do a set, so there would be a 3 hour or so evening. Anyway, the following week was when the first concert took place, actually at the Garage, and that was Grand Funk Railroad, who had been here a little earlier that summer is doing a free concert at Seasoned Good Pavilion. And they were a big hit. So that was a great way to open the Garage. There was a lot of energy behind them.
Did them at the Zoo Mini Pop, too.
And then Zoo Mini Pop, which was a standalone event and coincidentally was scheduled a week after Woodstock. It didn't have anything to do with Woodstock at all. But it ended up being a week later. And I had contracted with Hanley Sound to do the sound for the Garage. Hanley Sound was a national premier sound company that did the sound for Bill Graham at Filmware East and West. And I thought, and I met them when I went to visit with Graham and kind of understudy with him for a whole day at the Filmware in New York. And I thought if it was good enough for Graham, it was good enough for the Ludlow Garage. So I contracted with them to do the sound system at the Garage and for the Midwest Mini Pop Festival, which incidentally was Vanilla Fudge, Grand Funk Railroad, Lonnie Mack, Paul Butterfield Blues Band, which I think included Elvin Bishop at the time, mm-hmm. Balderdash, Sound Museum, which was a local group. It was great, kind of a unique event for Cincinnati, and it rained, of course, right in the middle of it. Mm-hmm. We ended up having a big mudslide in the Bear Pits parking lot, which is where it took place. The zoo has never been the same. There's still people walking around at the zoo wondering what was that. I guess one of the neat part of the festival was that the sound system I had contracted with turned out to be the same sound system they'd used at Woodstock. So Bill Hanley and his crew, not Bill himself, but his crew showed up at the Midwest Mini Pop Festival at the Cincinnati Zoo with these speakers all full of mud. And this ragtag group of roadies could hardly stand because of all the stuff they'd been through at Woodstock. Mm-hmm. Some would say, and I really can't verify this, that some of those same speakers stayed at the Garage and became part of the Ludlow Garage sound system. Flavor Scut became the house light show, sure. Which was one of the things that made the Garage unique. I mean, that was a component for some nightclubs, not for all, but for the Fillmores, for sure, it was a big part of their program.
If I remember something correctly, Jim, we did have something that the Fillmores didn't have. And that was the chairs.
Yeah, we had the chairs.
We had the Earl Camp.
And those were Pat Carroll chairs, weren't they?
Yeah, Pat and Jim Carroll.
Pat Carroll. And I remember them so well because
trademarked.
I had one in my store in the late 60s when I had Love's Coffee House across the street. And I had bought one of the rockers that was blue with a flower seat, and it was right in my front hallway. And the greatest thing about it was that these football players from UC would come over, and you'd have this guy who weighed about 320 or 340. He was a tackle, was 6'6", and they'd climb up at this into these chairs, and they'd like have a flashback of being a four-year-old or something, because in their life that they could never remember feeling that small.
Well, you have to explain that the chairs were huge, oversized chairs.
Yeah, the chairs
were. The seats were about chest high.
Right. The chairs were. I remember they were 36 inches wide because they had to be made so you could get them into a door.
Right. Mm-hmm.
That was, I think, Pat Carroll's standard.
Mm-hmm.
And the runners on the. On the rockers were 9 foot long.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they were wonderful. Now, I know my chair ended up in a strip joint.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, no. Either in Silverton or Reading, called My Room.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
Owned by Harvey Gottesman.
The other rocker actually suffered from rot at the bottom, and the legs, the rocker pieces were cut off, and it stands as a standing chair now, not as a rocker anymore. And a guy that worked at the garage named Dean Reynolds salvaged that. I don't know if he still has it, but he also has had the original sign that we recovered for the 94 reunion over in Eden Park, and then at the end of that I gave Dean the sign. So he may still have both of those original pieces.
So yeah, the idea behind the chairs was to create the theme for the environment was bigger than life. You know, just so when you walked in, you felt like this child in a bigger than life atmosphere. And the garage itself was big. I mean, for a club at that time, 10,000 square feet, which held about 750 people.
That was one of the beauties of the club, was that it was so open. And I remember times walking in and feeling like I was falling into an abyss. You know, the music would be going, the light show's on, it's maybe a little dark, and it's people laying on the floor or in the chairs.
Well, sitting on the very nice rugs.
Oriental rugs.
And you were like, transformed away.
The illusion began at the door, because the doors were specially constructed barn style doors that were over 11 feet tall.
14.
Up the ramp, and we had the oil can bathrooms, a Quaker State and Penn State oil can, that were humongous bathrooms, bigger than life. Marble pedestal sinks inside. It was a very, very unique atmosphere inside.
And the big question is, which was which? Which restroom was Pennzoil and which restroom was Quaker State?
I can tell you that. Right. Quaker State was the boys.
Quaker State was the boys.
Yeah.
I think the restrooms were perhaps 12 feet high and not quite that big in diameter, but
close.
So they were, you know, they were huge, and they were literally constructed and decorated like oil cans. And then we had a universal piece of furniture, 4x8, that was trying to figure out how to get the best, most useful piece of furniture out of a 4x8 sheet of plywood. And Ned Callahan, this just came up the other day. Ned Callahan was an architect, a budding architect, who came forward to help design this sort of universal piece of furniture that would serve as a seat or as a kind of a pillow. You could sit on the rugs on the floor and then lean back against this piece of furniture. Or we could stack them up on end and make them as kind of room dividers. But that was about it as far as the furniture is concerned. It was left open on purpose so you could get more people in, obviously. And as Bill was mentioning, when you came in through those 14-foot doors, you went downstairs first into the basement, this long ramp. So you really didn't know what was up, because it tended to be a little dark. And then you went by the concession stand. And
macrobiotic rice and fruit.
And bagels.
No liquor.
Didn't serve alcohol.
No. Important characteristics. I didn't want liquor because I wanted the attention to be on the music. I had the feeling that liquor was going to interfere with that. That's one of the reasons why that garage was allowed to exist. Had we applied for a liquor license, we wouldn't have gotten one. The people who owned the garage building prior to that were the people that had, what you mentioned, the Mug Club. And the Mug Club in Calhoun Street was taken down by the university, and so they had to move. So they bought the garage at the other end of Clifton. They were going to open a Beef and Brew, which would be another version of the Mug Club with bands and beer. Well, beer, liquor, was an important ingredient of their program, and the Clifton Town Meeting turned them down. So here comes the garage with a lot more hair, a lot more beards than the Mug Club would have had, and we were able to get a license because we weren't serving liquor. And that, so anyway, you went by the concession stand, and you came up the back steps, and then into a room, as others have already described, that was sort of bigger than life and unusual.
I got to see Iggy Pop.
Iggy was great.
You could hear him.
Yeah.
Splattering.
The one
on
you
the
could hear was Grand Funk.
Office.
MC5.
I love the MC5.
The MC5, when they came and the police asked them to turn it down, they
turned it up.
Yep. Matt was their big tribute to our evening.
Well, and you can't deny the Allman Brothers.
The Allman Brothers perfected their craft at our place, and they certainly entertained and gave Cincinnati a great time. I remember being down in the dressing room one day when we were working, and one of the other crew, Jeff Seaman, who went on to become the pedal steel and guitar player for a band called Wheels that reached some great notoriety here in Cincinnati. He's a wonderful player. And there he was with his new little red Fender Mustang guitar with Dwayne Allman teaching him how to play slide guitar. They were the nicest people you could imagine, as big of stars as they became.
Just one more morning. I had to wake up with the blues. Pull myself out of bed. I put on
Santana, talk about the chairs. They had a great time running from chair to chair and jumping up on the cushions and, and playing. And of course, they were not the biggest guys in the world, so they were jumping two and three into the chair because it was big enough to hold them all.
Were there any security issues at the garage?
No.
I don't ever remember any.
No, we didn't have a...
I don't remember.
Well, except when Pat Burney would walk in and flash his bailiff's badge at the door, and everybody would scatter to the four winds.
He could get in free.
I don't remember one arrest the whole time.
No. The only kind of problem we ever had, we had to kind of like the Outlaws motorcycle gang would come down with a certain band from Dayton area, and then the Iron Horseman guys or something might have to, you know, so we'd have to make sure that one group got out of show one before the other group came into show two. But, you know, I mean, everybody really got along. There was never any kind of fights or anything like that. We had
nothing.
We had very few problems with people ODing on drugs or anything else there.
We really didn't bring the problem.
Yeah, we didn't bring the problems that the community really anticipated. I think it
was
went off
mostly
really,
not
very
loud
well.
Noise complaints is what we had.
We had gone to some lengths to insulate
the doors.
Place, but
every time we opened the doors, people would complain.
Yeah. And UC professor was right in the firing line. The acoustics were such that the music that got out, it usually was through the roof where the skylights were. This building was, as I mentioned, 10,000 square feet. It was lit to a great extent during the daytime with these huge skylights, and unfortunately had to be covered up because of the noise. The ceiling was a series of steel trusses that went from one side to the other, so the whole 10,000 square feet was clear span. There were no posts, which is one of the reasons why it was so compelling, as Michael said. But despite all the soundproofing we did, a lot of the music did get out through the skylight and went right into Professor Fritz Nagel's living room. So somewhere I've got a box of letters from him.
Yeah, how much for tickets?
For the concerts that I mentioned, it might have been anywhere from $3 to $5.
Yeah.
It may have gotten up to $7.
Well, I think there were a couple where we were doing.
Yeah, when you might have had to go to Music Hall and pay $20. Yeah.
$250 to $350. I did some, that were
$12.50,
and a little bit more expensive when we had to rent a big place.
Nothing
And we did our own ticket sales, so of course there was no Ticketmaster. There was no.
And posters.
No,
nothing. Distributors.
Yeah.
You know, it was a culture of sorts, for sure. I mean, there was a network of support throughout the community. Kids bookstore downtown and
Marlboro
books and the bookstore in Yellow Springs, that the hotbed of radicalism, Antioch College.
I remember that. Yeah.
That was when, you know, the Independent Eye newspaper was going, Queen City Express was going, these alternative newspapers.
Did you see a difference in the type of music? Was the crowd bigger at, say, the Allman Brothers than Ross on Roland Kirk?
I think Cincinnati was desperate for music.
and they loved everything. Everything that was happening in this, during that period, they wanted to hear everybody.
Yeah, we were pretty cross-cultural. And we brought in all kinds of people. We had Seals and Crofts, and the Baha'i religion. We had Hindu people playing incredible string band doing and sitar music.
Each moment is different from any before it. Each moment is different. It's now. It's now. It's different from any before it. This moment is different. It's now.
Mountain showed up with their Hollywood entrance with the two white stretch limos out front. He came out with
I'm a star.
With the big furry coat on and the full on tried one on.
And,
Leslie West.
Oh. He was covered in fringe. He had a fringe jacket, his fringe pants, and when he came down the dressing room, started to get undressed to get ready for the show, he had a fringe shirt, and I would swear the man was fringed right down to his underwear. It was just amazing. He was the big Leslie guy, West. Too.
Then when Captain Beefheart came, Jim sent me over to pick him up in my 56 Chevrolet station wagon at the Norwood Quality Inn.
Yeah.
It could seat nine people.
I picked Neil Young up personally at the airport in my Plymouth? 53 Chrysler. Regimatic, you know, that sort of semi-automatic.
Hydromatic clutch.
Were you wearing the
hydromatic
yak
clutch.
Hair coat?
Oh, yeah.
Were you wearing the yak hair coat?
Decided to give Neil Young a tour of downtown on the way back from the airport, which is why he'll never ride in a 53 Chrysler again. I doubt if he would take a Tarbell tour again either. On his face, it would stop a truck. And I thought I was being nice, you know, pointing out these spots and going down alleys and over the Rhine. So I thought it was really cool. He just didn't understand.
No, and at the concert, he makes reference to it and says that the drive from the hotel to here was only a mile, but took better than an hour to get there. So
I have one little garage related story I have to tell. I guess it was an after party at Jim's house over on Union. He had that nice big house over in Avondale.
Commune.
We were in the library, and I got wind of the party, went over there, and there was a big jam session going on, and I think maybe it was the library, and we played all night, and then finally, about sunup, my friend Gary Glader and I decided to go get breakfast at the Bird in Mount Adams, and it was a really good band, really good musicians. I thought I sounded great, and I said, Gary, how'd I sound? He said, well, you sounded great, but he said, don't you think you should let Elvin Bishop play a little more? And I said, who?
I would like to say, would love to see some old independent eyes.
Posters?
Any memorabilia you have, bring it to the concert on the 7th of August at Sawyer Point as part of the Blues Festival.
It would just be fun. Anything we could find would be fun to help. Sure. Kind of solidify.
We'll have a booth down there. We've got CDs. We've got T-shirts. We'll have replicas of the old posters.
Talk about the CD and DVD project.
Well, we have some of the original music on tapes that managed to make it all these years. We've done a little bit of restoration. We've been working with an author, Scott Belmo Belmer, who's written several rock and roll books. And we've put a little package together that includes about 3 hours worth of music, some video, light show by our favorite Flavorscope folks. And we hope to have it there, along with a 24-page brief Cliff Notes history of the Ludlow Garage.
Cliff Notes.
And we're knocking off some T-shirts under the good graces of the Blues Festival. Some people who have apparently decided to put on about 50 bands over the weekend here in August have made us part of their theme stage, and we're bringing five bands of our own, some of which used to play for the Garage, including Balderdash and Bitter Blood Street Theater, one of my favorites. They do a little street theater stuff, some beat poetry, and some great music.
High away over the ocean, it is a pale mist, weaves a silver haze. Floating, shivering screens hang over a green garden in a starlit day. Through the endless blue sky, silently float the billowy clouds over a crystal tower. On a tower they sail like snow on a field of night. Under the clouds, fiery white, in a tower so clear, so darkly blue, flower pale girls to silent music glide and whirl on the silver floor. It is I that will float in a crystal tower, the white haired maidens, hour on hour, to a music too pure for ear to hear, too clear, too dark and true, forever to glide and weave. Forever to bend and whirl, slender bodies of the water girls, fragile sails on sleepy summer seas, forever glide on an island over the sea, forever glide. Away, I'll be sailing away to an island over the sea, where the water maids under the apple trees dance and sway in the bright air. Dance and sway all in an endless day under the silver bough of the pale apple bloom, where by the little waves flow the bright bodies bare, while the petals fall in the water blue in the clear air.
So that looks to be like a really wonderful show. We've got
Jeff Seaman coming back
with his son now, the Goshorn Brothers, who started with us as Mushroom Jones, Sacred Mushroom, and formed Pure Prairie League. Now they're going to come back as the Goshorn Brothers themselves and play a great set with keyboardist Stevie Schmidt. And we're going to close the night with a great tribute by Sonny Moorman and No Saints, No Saviors, doing Allman Brothers music from the original sets played there. So the show should be a great time, and the memorabilia should be fun to go off with and listen to in the future.
And that band will include Bob Nabe, who's one of the original Lemon Pipers,
Bruce
Dalton, Balderdash.
And most of the original Bitter Blood Street Theater folks, I think. Yeah. Did Peter Frampton play with Humble Pie during King's concert?
Ooh.
Only Peter Frampton, if you're out there listening, you can tell us whether you were with Humble Pie that evening.
So who was headlined that night?
That was the Kinks, right?
The Kinks.
And the Kinks.
Yeah.
They were great.
That was a rare moment. That was a distinguished audience. So what's the cut from Commander Cody that's on the CD?
Lost in the Ozone.
Lost in the Ozone.
And Down to
Seeds
and Stems Again. So, yeah, that was the name of the big album then.
1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4. Told you a million times that I loved you. Now your old fickle heart won't let me in. I'll just relax here, this glass of gin, and head for the ozone again. I'm lost in the ozone again. I'm lost in the ozone again. One drink of wine,
yeah. Two drinks of gin,
and I'm lost in the ozone again. Billy Kirchin on lead guitar. West Virginia Creeper.
Do you all remember the New Year's Eve 1969 concert that evening?
That would have been sort of the national, regional, and local combination, but in this case there were four. Uncle Dirty was a comedian,
right?
Didn't play music. Eli Radish was, I guess they were really a regional group at the time. Balderdash was local. Raven, I think, was national. James Gang was from Cleveland, but they had, I think by that time, it had achieved national
status. They were getting there, and they were actually, one of the guys in James Gang, the drummer, dated one of the folks in Eli Radish, and so they would try and be there together. Whenever James Gang played, Eli Radish would come, whether they played or they didn't.
B.B. King, Catfish.
Albert King was such
Albert
a nice
Albert King was
man.
Great.
Oh, B.B. King was a nice guy, too.
Albert King drove his own bus with the band sitting in the back, and left-handed guitarist, great musician.
He needed a ride back to the motel, the Quality Inn in Norwood, which was typically where we put people up. Well, Pat Burney volunteered to drive him, which was fine, except that Pat had just gotten a new Barracuda and ended up getting into a drag race on the way back to the motel and lost. And poor Albert was like... And the next day, Pat sold a car and bought a GTO. That's my Albert King story.
Flamin' Groovies, Golden Earrings, Iggy and the Stooges, MC5, Flock, NRBQ, Sunday Funnies, Brute Force. Brute Force is on the CD.
Yeah, great music.
Santana. Tracy Nelson, of course, who was one of the more memorable experiences we had there. She was so incredible.
Taj Mahal.
Ross Honorable and Kirk,
Martha Velez.
We're going to do you no good.
Staple Singers, Allman Brothers, their concert at the Garage was the first one north of the Mason-Dixon line. They were from Macon, Georgia, of course, and their first concert was a free concert that WBN and Jelly Pudding helped sponsor. Mm-hmm. Frank Wood, if you're out there, where are you? We need you.
Michael Xanadu.
Who could fill an evening by himself, of course, and the contribution that EBN and Jelly Pudding made at that time.
Instead of getting a haircut, let's get rid of rats and hunger. Let's go after joblessness and slum dwelling. Let's beat the crimes called prejudice, hate, and stupidity. And while we're at it, let's tear down several million billboards.
When I was on Calhoun Street with Just Any Old Thing, Shaker Plane, and we were the initial sponsors, and... A one-minute spot, I think, was $3. Spot.
When you hear the Santana cut, is it just one cut?
There's actually a couple
cuts
in there.
Yeah. The sound and engineering at the Garage was incredible. I think people are going to be surprised with this. This is the first public exposure that those recordings have gotten, with the exception of a couple cuts, NRBQ, did an album. The Allman Brothers did Live at Ludlow Garage. Mm.
Neil Young's got a couple cuts on his new compilations.
But except for that, none of these have been heard outside of just a few folks. I think people are going to be surprised and amazed at the stature of the musicians and the quality of the recordings there.
I pulled into Nazareth. I was feeling about a half past dead. Just needed a place where I could lay my head. Hey, mister, can you tell me where I might find a bed? He just grinned, shook my hand, no was all he said. Take a load off Fanny, take a load for free. Take a load off Fanny, and put the load right on, me. Well, yeah. I picked up my bags, I went looking for a place to hide. When I saw old Carmen and the devil walking side by side. And I said, hey, Carmen, come on, let's go downtown.
Dan Britt was our sound man, Rick Lemker and Dan Britt.
Dan did posters.
Well.
And you did posters.
Stu Levy did a lot of the posters, too.
Yeah.
Stu Levy, who, if you don't know, Stu Levy
he's a great
later worked with Ansel Adams.
Mm-hmm. Back on Dan Britt for a second, Dan lived down the street, I believe above
Tawana.
Tawana. Yeah.
Imports.
That Tawana Imports, that little kind of sort of.
It was down past Virginia Bakery.
It was. Jefferson Crossing Park.
It was a jewelry store, Tawana was.
Mm-hmm.
And
nice.
Dan lived upstairs, and he was a student at UC at the time, I think, in DAAP.
DAA, no P. No P in there when I graduated either, so.
On his way to, what became a great career in graphic arts. But at the time, just wandered into the garage one day, just wandered down the street from where he lived. And he never looked back. He didn't go home, I don't think. He pretty much stayed there 24 hours a day until it closed in January 71. And I think Dan, as much as anybody, is the heart and soul of the garage. His spirit of community and his initially volunteer was not really a trained sound technician. He was a sort of a sound geek. But he was a great student and became very proficient at recording engineering in a hurry, I think particularly with the help of Rick Lemker, who was
quite an accomplished
sound technician. He's been a real important part of this family from day one, a big part of the 25th reunion, putting that all together, and the same thing for this.
I think we're very lucky. Most of the crew that actually worked at the garage are going to be coming back for the event, as they have in the past. We all stay pretty much in touch, even though we're all over the country.
Don't ask about the 50th, though. That may be pushing it.
Oh, we'll really have some cool chairs.
I would like to think that...
Come in a bottle.
There we go.
I mean, it was started, you know, going back to the beginning as a community center of sorts. And it really was intended to be a place for people to come and share a sense of community. And music became the focal point. I think that the music of the garage, without question, is the legacy. The quality of the music, the quality of the sum total of the environment, the light show, the sound system, the attention to detail, technically. And, of course, the quality of the group and the juxtaposition of the different groups together at the same time. It was, I think, unique to Cincinnati. I don't know of anything, certainly in other forms of music, there have been similar accomplishments. But in the world of rock and roll or progressive rock, I think it was unique. As Michael said, it was short. The progressive rock scene was short.
But sweet as it could be.
Put your arms around me whenever he builds.
final concerts at the Ludlow Garage were on January 19th and 20th, 1971, with Captain Beefheart, Wright Cooter, and Pure Prairie League. The cost of doing business with the musicians brought an end to what had been an amazing venue for the times. The 40th anniversary of the Ludlow Garage will be celebrated Friday night, August 7th, at the Cincy Blues Fest along the Ohio River at Sawyer Point. There will be a limited edition CD-DVD set available at the Ludlow Garage table at the Blues Fest, along with posters and t-shirts. You can find a link to the Ludlow Garage and Cincy Blues Fest at WVXU.org. Technical assistance from Carmen De Leon, Mary Peel, Kevin Rowinski, Forrest Griffin, and Chelsea Vandedrink. This tribute to the 40th anniversary of the Ludlow Garage was produced and hosted by Lee Hay. Mm-hmm.